Good morning. Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan, Kansas. My name is Michael Oldfather. The order of service identifies me as the convener. What, you might ask, does that mean? The program that in advance of the Sunday service, conveners work with speakers, musicians, and other participants in the service to do whatever it takes to mount a program that proceeds smoothly, and I should add, starts on time, appears to be organized around a presenter or presenter's themes, and that satisfies the UUFM 11th commandment to conclude the service no later than noon. It is our habit here to make people feel that they are welcome here, whatever their political affiliation, however much of their lives they have squandered on formal education, whether they are very young or very old or somewhere in between, whatever their sexual orientations, and within reason, however they describe their religious tastes and preferences. Many of us don't pray much, but if we did, we would ask for civility, consideration, and succinct questions and comments. If there comes a time when comments and questions from the floor are in order, we ask that speakers use the talking stick so that their words can be recorded for absent members and friends who listen to the service later, and so that they can be heard by members wearing headsets. Yeah, thanks. Thanks. Later this morning, our guest speaker, Graham Criker, will tell us something about looming changes at the Unitarian Universalist Association, the UUA, where he serves as a board member representing some 63 congregations, by my count, in 7 states, or parts of them, that comprise the Prairie Star District. Before Graham speaks, my comments and readings will mostly be designed to provide some background for how 2 similar but very distinctive denominations, the American Unitarian Association and the Universalist Church of America, the AUA and the UCA, respectively, came to be united into the UUA in 1961. It's a surprisingly fascinating story. Here's hoping my necessarily abbreviated version of it will tempt you to dig deeper on your own. I think you will find the time spent doing so very rewarding. There are announcements in the bulletin. Please commit them to memory. There is additional information about us and our denomination available in the monthly newsletter, copies of which are located in the narthex, the room that came in here, as well as our website, UUFM.net, provides copious information about our activities, as well as links to regional and national UU bodies. Following the service, we hope visitors and members will stay with us for light refreshments and stimulating conversations. Questions about us will be welcomed by anyone wearing a name tag or me who left his at home. If he or she doesn't know the answer, somebody close by will. In addition, I have 2 announcements to read. Annelle Forster, make your presence known here, will be happy to order name tag replacements or new ones, and is getting ready to do that. Les Fraser, raise your hand, Les, so I see who you are. Les Fraser has a petition to sign asking us to implore, beg, do whatever it takes to get K-Man to cancel the radio station, the program put on by Rush Limbaugh. And anyway, he'll be real happy to talk to you about that in the narthex after the service. The opening words, which will get us to the chalice lighting and the formal start of this service, come from a 1960 sermon by Reverend Donald Harrington, then minister of the Community Church of New York, which celebrated the birth of Unitarian Universalism, the consolidation of the 2 traditions. The concluding section of the sermon, Voices of Our Heritage, expresses our debt to some of the people to whom all of us who value liberal religion should owe so much. Michael Servetus, man of the lion heart, who stood alone and wrote, preached in season and out, and was burned at the stake in the flames of his own books for his belief that God is one. Jan Hus, who in Bohemia sounded the call for freedom of theological thought before the coming of the Reformation. In the face of warnings, he persisted and died a martyr for his faith. Francis David, transcendent orator of the Spirit, who in Transylvania won the world's first edict of religious tolerance, made a Unitarian king and built a free church that has flourished for more than 400 years. No man, he said, should ever be persecuted for his religious faith. Joseph Priestley, scientist, minister, humanitarian, who fought for religious freedom in his native England and carried the fires of liberalism to the shores of America. He preached out boldly what he thought without apology or hesitation, defending and urging his views ably and fearlessly, and putting courage into the hearts of the liberal dissenters of his age. We remember with gratitude the founders of the Universalist Brethren, John Murray, Benjamin Rush, and George de Benneville, who in the 18th century left the security of orthodoxy to raise the banner of universal salvation and the uncompromised goodness and graciousness of God. They set the first stones in the edifice of American liberalism. We remember with gratitude Charles Chauncey, Jonathan Mayhew, Henry Ware, William Ellery Channing, and Theodore Parker. They led our American ancestors out of the theological wilderness and summoned them to believe in the perfectibility of humankind. They laid the foundation and reared the structure of American Unitarianism and put it to work in every cause of human service. We remember with gratitude Hosea Ballou, who made Universalism Unitarian and mightily advanced the cause of rational religion. His method was dignified and noble. His spirit was Christian. His practical teaching was wise and effective. He argued like Socrates. He pleaded like Paul. He was, it was said, serene as the firmament. We remember with gratitude Ralph Waldo Emerson, who made Unitarianism universalist, and from pulpit and platform all over this land proclaimed the mighty power of the human spirit and the universality of truth. We light the chalice this morning in gratitude to all the women and men who sounded the call for a universal free fellowship open to all seekers of truth, of goodwill, of whatever background of faith. Both the opening and closing hymns this morning played prominent roles in the merger of the Unitarian and Universalist traditions. More to say about that later. For now, please rise as you're able and join in the singing of number 145 as Tranquil Streams.
Thank you.
Now is the time for children of all ages to pay heed to the message, and those who are really children, barely really children still, are invited to come forward.
Okay, everybody come on down.
Hey there, Connor.
Today is a very special children's conversation because our classes from pre-K, K through second, and third through eighth are going to be presenting what they have learned this semester with their teachers. So you may remember in the fall that we shared learning about the seven principles and our social action project. And starting in January, the preschoolers continued with their Chalice Children curriculum. But the K through second and third through eighth graders began a unit on the Christian and Judeo roots of Unitarian Universalism by studying Bible stories and the messages that we get from those. So I'm going to let the teachers go into a little bit more detail, and they're also going to be presenting the students in their class. We're going to start with the preschoolers. Could all of the preschoolers please stand with your teacher, Sandy?
Hi, Owen. We have Owen Zeller. Jump up and down, Owen Zeller. Yay! And we have here today, Kaya Bonella. Jump up and down, Kaya Bonella. And we have Rose Tonona. Jump and down. Woohoo! And there are other kids that aren't here today, right? There's, oh my gosh, Kieran and Luke and Jocelyn's over there from our class, Carter and Jake. Jake's not here yet. So we've been studying, pre-K can study, a book called Chalice Children. And it's a real book that has real lesson plans. And one of the things we've done is learn a song that we sing to welcome everyone. Are you ready? Owen, can you come stand up here with the girls and we'll sing our song? Ready? And who should we, well, let's say, okay, are we ready? Can you all sing into the microphone?
We are Chalice Children.
Welcome to our circle. We are Chalice Children. We are Chalice Children. Let's all welcome everyone. We are Chalice Children. And we've studied, what have we talked about? We've talked all year, we've talked about how the church is a place where there are... Church is a special place. Say it again.
The church is a special place. The church is a wonderful place. Shout!
Where we can shout. And it's a wonderful, special place where we can shout. And we've wondered about what kinds of things?
Rainbows.
And
moons and stars.
Moons and stars. And we studied about different holidays.
We like to scream.
And that, in a nutshell, is what the pre-K kids have done. Right? Now we're going to hear from the K through second grade class. Leah, you go first. Here, turn.
Since January, we have been learning Bible stories. When we learned about Noah, we built an ark.
Thank you so much, Leah, for getting us started. Nick's holding our ark, and with the ark, I've dropped the dove. With the ark, we have a lovely rainbow and a dove at the end of the story also was one of the art projects that we did. We also learned about Moses, and when we did, we painted pictures. And so this is Jocelyn's picture of when Moses was in the basket and got rescued from the river, which was super fun day for painting, and Amy came to help, so that was wonderful. And then, what else? Can you help me over here, Ronan, please? Okay, and so then when we learned about David and Goliath, we traced Dick Beeman. Dick Beeman was our Goliath, and the various children got to be David. And when we were doing this lesson, we made armor like Goliath might have worn, and this is one of the pieces of armor. And I know that spending so much time on the Bible can be somewhat controversial for families and members of the fellowship, but I think the biggest controversy that's made its way to my ears was this was on our bulletin board, and the men's group was debating every week what we were doing with a toilet seat. So this is a helmet for Goliath, if anyone is interested. But I will just say, as a parent, having Nick in my class and going over these stories with him, we have been able to share a joke about a burning bush, because there was actually a bush on fire in our neighborhood. He picked out the word Hebrew off of a poster and thought that was very special that he knew something about that word. And what else? Oh, he was watching Mythbusters the other night, and they made a reference to David and Goliath, and he was very happy to know all the ins and outs of that. So it's been a wonderful experience to share with the kids, and I'm so grateful they've been here. We're missing Burke Bellinger. He's been at most of our lessons, and Lauren and Carrie, who we both lost. But it's been a great semester, so thank you all, and thank you for letting us do this.
The third through sixth grade class suffers from an artistically limited teacher. But we've done a number of plays. And in our discussions about Bible stories, we've pushed the correct notion that the stories are very similar to stories that other non-Hebrew cultures told. The stories of the flood, we ran into Babylonian stories. We ran into, later on, we ran into Greek gods that were similar to the stories that we told. In class, any particular plays or stories that you remember? Connor? Samaritan, yeah, that's right. And I might add that in the story of the Good Samaritan, one of the points was that the person who did well, the person who acted in a Unitarian Universalist way, was an outcast. And I asked the kids, if you brought that story up to date, who would play the roles in the modern world? And they mentioned a mayor was going to be one of the in place of the priest.
Businessman.
A businessman would play the role of the Levite who went by. And do you remember who you thought would be the role of the outcast? Kids. So, in our artistic limited way, what we'd often do was act out the stories, and the kids do well with plays. Let me tell you. In any case, today we'll conclude our stories of the Bible with the stories of that come out of the book of Revelation and some of the popular images of heaven and hell, and how that plays into our universalist tradition in particular. So it's been a great year with a great bunch of young people.
I love how our third through sixth graders are the most shy. Stand on up. We're going to say your names. Destiny and Maeve and Lily and Helen and Clara and Connor and William is also in this class. And so thank you guys. I know you're shy, but that's okay. You can sit back down. We had to call a little attention to you. So as Larry mentioned, today is our last lesson, and next week we'll be sort of doing a reflective piece, and then coming this summer is the World Travelers Program, and we've talked a little bit about that, and you've seen some flyers. I just want to remind our tour guides that we're doing host sessions today and next week at 12:15 in the Jupiter Room. It will only be about 10 minutes just going over what the schedule looks like. But thank you all for listening to our wonderful lessons. They've learned a lot, and we're very excited for the conclusion of the spring and the beginning of the summer adventures. So thank you. Go now.
Now is the time in our order of service when people might want to say something about milestones in their lives, their special joys and concerns that weigh on their minds now. So if you have something to say, there'll be a microphone coming to you right now.
I'm Lori Cross of the Aesthetics Committee. And I'm very happy to tell you what you can notice. The exhibition has been changed out in the foyer, and it's just wonderful. I'd like to thank the people who hung it, who were Kim Bellender, who isn't here, Dick Beeman, and Tom Manning did a very good job of hanging it. And we have many new members who have contributed for the first time. I'm very, very pleased about that. And I'm also pleased about the Old Faithful who came through and with more exhibitions. Thank you.
Anna Franklin, I just want to say that I'm very happy to welcome Terry Franz to the Happy Kitchen crew. And she started this past Friday and got through without any major mishaps, so thank you Terry. Oh, and one more thing, I also want to thank Jennifer Bryan, who is my new assistant coordinator at Happy Kitchen, and has been doing a lot to help me too, so thank you both of you.
Dick Beeman, don't miss the eclipse of the sun tonight. Right at sunset, just before sunset. So right as the sun sets, it'll be just a crescent, about 80% covered.
I have a concern that people might look directly at the sun since the eclipse makes it seem a lot dimmer, but that will in fact burn your corona. Please make a pinhole camera, which you can do by sticking a needle through like a piece of cardboard and then project it onto like a white piece of paper and watch it that way so you do not damage your eyes.
You're first. My daughter, Clara, who's 11 years old, made the Silver Orchestra, and I don't know if any of you guys know what that is, but she had to audition for that, and that meant lots and lots of begging her to practice over the last 2 months, so we're really proud of her for doing that.
I'm Kathleen Oldfather, and our son met his future wife at Gold Orchestra, so you never know. One of the great paintings hanging out there by Dick Beeman is a painting of Brock Dale, one of our members who passed away, and Dick is in the picture. And Brock's son, Quentin, is here today, and I assume grandson, Brandon. So welcome. Glad to have you here.
For those joys and concerns that you have chosen not to share with us, we share them anyway. What follows borrows liberally from William Ross's excellent 2001 book, The Premise and the Promise, which details the somewhat tortured process which culminated in the unification of the Universalist and Unitarian denominations into the Unitarian Universalist Association, whose name was soon modified to the Unitarian Universalist Association of Congregations, just to be sure who we are. The first stirrings of interest in yoking the two denominations occurred in the middle of the 19th century. Reading the history of the process, the 100-year process, one marvels that it finally came to fruition. Initially, and in fact well into the process, there were fairly significant theological differences between the two groups. In simplest terms, the Unitarians believed that salvation, whatever that might mean, resulted from behavior. It was salvation by works. The Universalists belonged to the salvation by faith camp, embracing its most extreme form, the notion that salvation for all, no matter what kinds of lives they might have led. Thomas Starr King, who was minister at the First Unitarian Church in San Francisco in the 1860s, and arguably the most important single player in the successful effort to keep California out of the Confederacy, had this to say about the difference between the two. The one thinks God is too good to damn them forever. The other thinks they are too good to be damned forever. Put them whatever you want to be in there. By the middle of the 20th century, the two U's had grown so close theologically that it was difficult to distinguish between their belief systems. The differences that stood in the path of institutional merger that seemed insurmountable to many in both denominations were geographical, cultural, and structural. The Unitarians were initially concentrated in New England, especially in the Boston area, while the Universalist congregations were located often in smaller towns throughout the Midwest and the South. Unitarian churches outside of New England gravitated to the large cities. Unitarians tended to be wealthier and better educated than Universalists, though the differences were not as great as they had been in earlier times. For many Universalists, there was concern that merger would come down to being submerged. Unitarians had their own seminaries and a strong presence in many of the country's most prestigious seminaries. Most Universalist ministers had come from less rigorous preparation, having experienced heartfelt conversions from rigid faith systems to a movement that warmly welcomed skeptics and free thinkers. The Universalists were very good at starting churches, but not so good at providing the institutional support to keep them going. Kansas is loaded with Universalist churches. The Unitarians, on the other hand, did have a fairly strong centralized governance system that allowed congregations, once started, to prosper. In face of these and other not insignificant differences, beginning not long after the Civil War, there were U's of both camps who wished to form some sort of alliance. The common theme then and for nearly a century was that it just didn't make sense for two denominations so close in terms of both theology and commitment to the same causes to dilute their influence by going their separate ways. At the congregational level, a few churches began to join both denominations, the first being in Muckwananga, I think, Wisconsin, southeast part of the state, in 1878. Beginning in the late 1890s, both groups regularly passed resolutions authorizing exploration of how to unify the two denominations, but little came of that until much later. The first significant cooperative venture involved the production of a hymnal to be used by both denominations. A committee of eight, four from each U, produced Hymns of the Spirit, which was printed and copyrighted in 1937. This might be considered a kind of stealth attack. Leaders in both camps reasoned that people singing the same hymns might begin to focus on more on common beliefs and less on real and imagined differences. It was widely adopted by both Universalist and Unitarian congregations all across the country and laid some of the groundwork for the eventual unification. In 1964, after the merger, the denomination, again a joint effort, produced, this was called Hymns for the Celebration of Life. And this came out in 1964 and was the hymnal most widely used until what's now called the Gray Hymnal came into use. it was widely adopted and laid some of the groundwork for eventual unification. A second major event to foster cooperation occurred in 1951. When the American Unitarian Youth and the Universalist Youth Fellowship held their first national meeting. At their 1954 national conference, they voted overwhelmingly to become a single entity, beating their folks to the post there, calling themselves Liberal Religious Youth, the LRY. Unitarian minister Samuel Anthony Wright wrote and the kids sang for the first time, "We Would Be One," set to Finlandia, Jane Sibelius's majestic orchestral piece, and we'll sing it at the close of the service later this morning. I've known well many people from all over the country who were active in LRY between 1954 and the early 1960s. That dates me, doesn't it? The accounts of their experience make it clear that Reverend Wright, who became the LRY director, and others who led local and regional youth groups were on to something. The time was right. The friendships formed between young Universalists and Unitarians convinced a whole generation of progressive kids that unification was a no-brainer. I'm not sure how much they influenced their parents and other elders to support unification, but it's a factor that shouldn't be discounted. Something I am certain about involves what became of so many of those early LRY members. Its veterans include dozens of the ministers who were ordained in the first 15 years after unification, women and men who led UU congregations and provided guidance in making the transition from two denominations to one. Possibly even more important have been the contributions scores of former LRYers, now in their 70s and early 80s, that they have made to continue to make as effective, dedicated lay leaders. Finally, we reach 1956 and the establishment of the Joint Merger Commission. William Rice, its head, was raised a Universalist and ordained as a Unitarian minister. The commission did two really smart things. First, in spite of great opposition, they hired professional consultants at the cost of $50,000. In today's terms, that'd be about $200,000, no small amount of money. Second, they set out to make no recommendations themselves. Instead, the plan was to involve every congregation in wide and open dialogue, seeking all points of view. To facilitate the dialogue, the commission distributed a stream of documents illuminating all aspects, as fairly as they could, of the decision to be made. Then all congregations were invited to participate in two plebiscites. The first was to be advisory. Should the commission proceed? The second was to be decisive. The campaign was brilliantly conceived and skillfully managed. Three quarters of both congregations voted, and 75% of those taking part in both camps voted to proceed. In 1959, the next step, 600 Unitarians and 400 Universalists met, sometimes in integrated small groups and eventually separately, to review and then vote on the merger issue. The stories of this meeting and all that was involved remind you of, well, good democracy, but messy democracy. While the process was unwieldy, they made the sausage and came up with a document to review by both groups, congregations, who then selected delegates to a 1960 joint meeting in Boston. There, both groups voted for unification by margins well in excess of the required 75% supermajority. The last event in Boston was Donald Harrington's sermon that I mentioned earlier. Unitarian Universalism, yesterday, today, and tomorrow. At the service's conclusion, hundreds of UU ministers who had been waiting in the wings moved into Symphony Hall and joined the delegates to sing the recessional hymn, the one we just sang. As tranquil streams that meet and merge and flow to meet the sea, our kindred fellowships unite to build a church that shall be free. Many years later, William Donovan, described by someone who knew him well as, quote, a fairly dry-eyed type, gave this account of the event. We sang it over and over again. There were people around us in tears. I guess there were tears in my eyes, too. The first few years of consolidation often hit rough patches. Lots of big egos on all sides complicate such processes. But tactful, patient, and dedicated professional leaders, staff members, and unpaid lay volunteers have been available in abundance to smooth the road. Just how our Association of Congregations will weather the new set of challenges facing us remains to be seen. It will be a treat for us to hear from one of those tactful, patient, and dedicated lay volunteers about today's challenges and plans for managing them. I looked for music that would, recorded music that would somehow fit the theme, and it takes a little imagination to get to the Prophet, that's P-H-E-T, bird, by Robert Schumann and recorded by the Russian pianist Pavel Yegorov. And now we will, while that plays, we will pass the pipe. Bram Greiker has given a great deal of time to service of liberal religion here and elsewhere in earlier haunts. It's a great pleasure to welcome him back to our pulpit. Graham.
It's a distinct honor to be here. It's an honor to be invited once. It's a distinct honor to be invited twice. So I thank you all. Michael has pretty much identified the fact that we're all in the same handbasket now, and the question is, where are we going in that handbasket? But before I get into the serious part of the talk, I want to say that I hope a lot of us are going to be going to GA 2012 in Phoenix in June. As you might remember, in 2010, when the General Assembly was up in Minneapolis, there was quite a bit of discussion about whether to boycott Arizona because of the sheriff they've got down in there who's violating so many people's civil rights, and their Senate bill, which further infringed on people's rights. And it was the vote of the delegates at that General Assembly that, in the face of those obstacles, we would go there to witness for social justice and stand on the side of love. Excuse me. As a result, about 3,500 Unitarians will be going to Phoenix in June, and I certainly hope that some of you are among them. Where else are we going to be going? Well, in 2014, the Prairie Star District Conference will be held in Topeka, and I'm certain that the I-70 choir will be performing there, and I hope you're all there to listen to their fine performance. Beyond that, in 2016, the General Assembly will be held in Kansas City. So that's some things to look forward to. In terms of rotation, the Prairie Star District Conference next year will be in Cedar Rapids, and then it's going to come to Topeka. The General Assembly next year will be in Louisville, then it's going to Portland, then Columbus, Ohio, then Kansas City. So for us Midwesterners, it's nice to have some opportunities to get hooked up here locally. Now, there are four things going on at the UUA today that I want to tell you about. I've been to 18 congregations, some more than once, and when I go there as a trustee, it's not to make a talk like I am now. It's to listen to people's comments, complaints, and concerns so I can carry them back to the board. After all, I was elected by the delegates of the Prairie Star District to be your representative, and that's my job. Now, Michael mentioned that they spent $50,000 back in the time in around 1959, 60, 61 to help set the course for our new organization. And that was big money back then. I was riding in New Orleans in a car with Natty Averett, who is a black woman who happens to be the president of the congregation in Fairfax, Virginia, and a trustee from that part of our country. She said to me and Pat Manley, a trustee from Boston, do you realize, first of all, how much money is the UUA going to take in and spend this year? Does anybody have a wild guess? $22 million. She said, do you realize over the next 50 years, we're going to take in and spend over $1 billion? It's a lot of money. What are we going to get for it? And then she said, let's look backwards in time. In terms of current purchasing power, we probably took in about $1 billion in the first 50 years of the Unitarian Universalist Association. And what did we get for that money? Maybe it wasn't $1 billion, maybe it was $763 million, but it was a lot of money. And what we got after 50 years was a net gain denominationally of 211 members. While the population of the United States was doubling, we only had a gain of 211 members. And surely all of you know we have a better story to tell for the citizens of this country in terms of being a welcoming congregation and a safe, liberal place where people can express their views and grow spiritually. Michael mentioned LRY, which became YFU, and then our funding for a national organization for young people just evaporated. So what we see happening is over these last 50 years, we had one president after another that was elected. They weren't all ministers. They were elected on a platform that they ran on, and they felt when they got elected, their job was to carry out that platform. And so what happened is that there were zigzagging, one after another, careening through history with different objectives every time a new president was elected. That's not a way to run a railroad or a denomination. So things had to change, and the way they're changing is that our denomination is moving from the form of governance we had for 50 years to a new form of governance called policy governance. Now, with policy governance, the board sets policy, empowers staff to carry it out, and monitors staff to ensure those goals are met. In the past, the board's members would go to Boston and hear endless reviews from the Finance Committee, the RE Committee, the Extension Committee, the Ministerial Committee, all talking about what happened in the past and vote to approve these reports. Nothing could do about it anyway because everything had already happened. But it was a non-functional way to run an organization. An example of how difficult things could be with policy governance is that when Katrina struck New Orleans, there was an outpouring of emotion and money from Unitarians across the country. And it happened that both the UUA was collecting money for Katrina relief and the Unitarian Universal Service Committee was collecting money for Katrina relief. The total combined pot was $3.6 million, a drop in a bucket compared to the total needs in New Orleans, but a fantastic response from our members nationally. So what happened is that the president of the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee met in New Orleans with a deputy representing the president of the UUA. Between the two of them, they decided they would split that money between the congregations and other organizations doing relief work in New Orleans. Now, suppose a tornado came through here and ruined your RE wing here, and it had to be replaced, and all the Unitarians raised the money to replace it, and then suddenly somebody at a higher level says, well, we're only going to give half that money to Manhattan because there's other people suffering, other churches, schools. So if we raise $1 million to help the church in Manhattan, they'll get half that money, and the rest of their half will go to help other people in Manhattan. I mean, that's a worthy objective, but it's no way to have a decision-making process take place. So moving forward, there will be policies in place about how money is collected on a national level and how it's going to be distributed. It was such a serious situation that the UUA board met in New Orleans and spent 3 days working in relief efforts there in the community with local organizations, met with each of the leaders of each of the three congregations there that are still suffering and still trying to rebuild themselves, and we're going through a reconciliation process and moving forward in a way that we hope heals those old wounds. Well, policy governance, if it's implemented correctly, will eliminate these kinds of problems by establishing goals, which are called ends, that will determine what is the purpose of our organization today and what are the goals that will justify our existence in decades to come. Ends are often reviewed and modified if necessary to assure that we are spreading our scarce cash and human resources in the best possible way to achieve our ends. Policy governance may not be the favorite of UUA presidents who like to get elected on a platform and then have a freewheeling authority to enact the programs of their platform. In the future, we may have a new type of president elected, dedicated solely to helping us meet the ends of the organization, and that would be okay. Our ends are the result of linkage with congregations, with clergy, with district presidents and other authorities, often using surveys such as the current Gathered Here program. Now, while all this is going on, a decision was made to downsize our board. At the present time, we have 19 districts in the UUA. Each district at their annual conference elects someone to be a delegate on the Board of Trustees. In addition to those 19 trustees, we have an elected treasurer, an elected moderator, an elected financial advisor, and we have a president who's now Peter Morales, and the presidents don't vote. Our association of congregations, more or less 1,000, each congregation has total polity. They decide what kind of building they're going to have, what kind of services they're going to have, who they're going to hire, what they're going to do in the community. We have independent congregations working separately. They elect delegates to a district conference, and those delegates in turn elect a trustee. I'm the last one to serve in that kind of a capacity, because starting after next year, the trustees, there will be 11, and they will be elected at large. There is a nominating committee that's been appointed, and they are doing a nationwide search for candidates to be trustees starting after 2013. So it's different, and we'll have to see how it works. A lot of people resisted this idea because it's nice to think that you had a chance to vote for someone who's going to represent you at the national level. And this is changing, and we'll just have to see how that works out. So that is policy governance. I mentioned the reduction in the size of the board. Now, another thing that's going on at the present time is that the board has agreed that the UUA will sell all the property they own on Beacon Hill in Boston and move somewhere else. Many people think of 25 Beacon Street as our historic home of the UUA. And I want to say right off the bat, I don't think that the Unitarian Universalism is a geocentric religion, and that we shouldn't think of 25 Beacon Street as our St. Peter's, and we shouldn't think of it as our Mecca. It's just an office building. And to make it even more dramatic, where the office is right now is not 25 Beacon Street, and I'll tell you why. And that is, originally, if you looked at the state capitol in Massachusetts up on the hill overlooking Beacon Hill, 25 Beacon Street was a building on the right side of the capitol. And then it turned out the state legislature decided they needed to double the size of the capitol and put a big wing on either side. So using right of eminent domain, they just condemned the properties on either side. 25 Beacon Street disappeared. Then the Unitarian Universalists, in those days just Unitarians, they got a hold of a piece of property on the left side of the Capitol where they built a headquarters that would soon be 100 years old, if it lasts that long. And then, can you imagine that if Michael and some of your other leaders went to Senator Brownback and said, Senator, they tore down our old building, Governor, would like to use our old address as our new address. I mean, chances are you couldn't even get an audience with the governor. But the Unitarians back in the early 20th century had so much pull that when they tore down 25 Beacon Street and built a new building at 32 Beacon Street, the legislature passed a law that said they could use 25 Beacon Street as their address. So there was a time in our country when UUs had some pull at the national and state level. So I was had actually been to Boston previously on business and stayed in the facilities there at 25 Beacon Street because Beacon Street, we'll say it runs more or less east and west, and the next block north, that is called Mount Vernon Place. And the Unitarian Universalists purchased two homes there and made them into guest houses, and they're named after two former presidents, Pickett and Elliott. So Pickett and Elliott House, our guest house, where any of you going to Boston, if you can demonstrate your UU, can stay there at a fairly low cost. And that's ideal for having our people go there, and you might think stay there at a low price, but that's really not the case. Now I'll tell you why. I went, anyway, I had stayed there previously, and last October I went to my first meeting as a board member there, and instead of walking all the way around the block to go in the front door like other people, I went down a little alleyway and in the back door and into the basement. And then I was going to take the elevator upstairs. There are six floors, but the elevator only goes to the first five. I went into the basement, and there was a door propped open. And a big sign on the door said, "Never leave this door open." I took that as an invitation to go in, and I was absolutely stunned because it was like when Abbott and Costello meet Frankenstein in that laboratory. That's what it was like down in the basement. Two huge boilers that looked like they came out of destroyers in World War II, slathered in asbestos. All kinds of junction boxes and wiring going this way and that way. And I thought, we got to get out of here as quick as we can. I mean, it looked like the fire marshal ought to be there that afternoon and condemn the place. Well, I went over down the hall to get on the elevator to go upstairs. And when the door opened, much to my surprise, there's a guy with a push cart full of rotten wood and roof shingles. And I said, it looks like he'd been up on the roof. He said, yes, I'm up there every day. It's rotting away faster than we can replace it. We've got to get a whole new roof put on here within the next year or so. Well, I'm trying to describe this place. 25 Beacon Street, as we know it, has a fantastic suite of offices for the president. And in keeping with the times, all the other people have little cubicles. They're not even cubicles. They're like pantries or closets. No central air conditioning. The UUA has their staff spread over 18 floors in four different buildings. So you can imagine trying to get a meeting called. It's an incredible situation. It's estimated it will cost between $6 and $10 million to renovate the properties on Beacon Hill, which will just keep them up to date but not make them any more efficient. Now, it happens that Beacon Hill in Boston is the priciest residential property in Boston. It's where John Kerry lives and many other notable individuals. So it's estimated that we could sell our properties on Beacon Hill, which are the two guest houses, a house used as an office building at 41 Mount Vernon Place and 25 Beacon Street. We could sell all those together for between $25 and $30 million. If we did that, we could buy a modern, efficient, all on one or two floors place with handicapped access that we don't have, available to public transportation, which is very good in Boston. And we could probably do that for $10 or $12 million and then put $10 million into our endowment, which would generate about $500,000 a year that we would have to do better programming for congregations. And if we look at it, the role of the UUA is to help promote congregations and see to their welfare and the growth of our denomination. So, just one interesting thing about it is in that basement, there's a huge mail room. And that in itself tells you what was going on, because they used to have a staff of people there getting ready, putting stuff in sacks every day from Beacon Press, from Skinner House, all newsletters and stuff. Now everything's gone almost everything's gone electronic. They don't use that mail room at all anymore. It's just old files jammed in there. At Beacon headquarters, there's a restroom on every floor. The women are 1, 3, and 5. The men are 2, 4, and 6. So you can see what I'm getting at. Now, I talked about the guest house there. If the guest houses were sold, they'd probably bring about $6 million in money. That money could be invested, and we could afford to put up all our guests coming to Boston at the Copley Plaza Hotel, which is nearby and one of the finest, most expensive hotels in the city. And after doing that, we would save about $340,000 a year. So when you think of the kind of budgets we operate our congregations on here in the Midwest, $340,000 is a big savings. So taking all that into account, the logical thing to do was move. And someone said, well, why don't you move to Kansas City or Indianapolis or St. Paul? Well, the fact is, our organization is not robust enough to withstand that kind of a move. Over 70% of the staff, when they were surveyed, said they wouldn't move. You can see why. Some have elderly parents. Many have spouses in very good-paying jobs. Some of them have homes underwater. There's a variety of reasons why people could not, in good conscience, move if the headquarters moved. There's an organization that specializes in helping congregations and nonprofits, whether it's the Boy Scouts or the Odd Fellows, move headquarters, and they say it takes about 16 years to make back the loss you have in expertise and the cost of moving and getting started over. So the decision was made to sell our properties in an orderly fashion on Beacon Hill and move into a handicapped, accessible, modern facility that will meet our needs for the coming decades. Now, in closing, I want to talk about what's happening in terms of our districts. Presently, the UUA has 19 districts. By 2014, they will have 5 regions. And why are we going to do this? Well, I'll read some reasons. We have 19 districts, each with different governance models. We have 19 boards. We have 19 due structures that don't match up. And we have different financial arrangements with UUA. We have 19 budget and accounting systems, 19 personnel systems, 19 IT systems, 19 staff groups with duplicate responsibilities. And we have historically had very little communication among boards. So as webinars become popular, as email becomes popular, as congregations seek better expertise from district executives, the logical thing to do is to merge districts into regions where the staff will be able to give financial expertise, RE expertise, IT expertise, and so on. That's already happened here in our Midwest. We are going to become what's called the Mid-America region. That includes the Heartland District, Indiana, Kentucky, Michigan, and Ohio, with 54 congregations and 7,500 members. The Central Midwest District has 80 congregations in Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, Missouri, and Wisconsin, with 13,000 members. And at Prairie Star, you know our territory, we have 63 congregations and 9,300 UUs. So our staff and the staff of the other two districts, our paid staff, are working together already. And we already have one RE director who is Nancy Combs Morgan, and she's full-time, and she covers the whole region. And so far, it's worked out very well. The boards of the three districts will meet together for the first time in a joint retreat in Rock Island, Illinois, in August. So we're moving forward with this project. Already, I should tell you that, let me see what we've done so far. We have actually voted in Indianapolis and in Springfield and in Minnesota earlier this year up in Bloomington that we are going to go forward with this. All the funding has been arranged. All the motions have been made and passed so we can move forward with regionalization. And my experience with the Prairie Star District Board is that far too much time is spent by the board and by our staff simply maintaining the bylaws and doing administration work instead of actually helping congregations, which is what the people want to do. That's why they get those jobs. And then they get just so bogged down in administration work. So I think of this as a step forward. According to the clock, there are 7 minutes left, and I'm going to ask if there's any questions. Or yes, sir.
If I understand it, you mentioned there were 211 gain in 50 years of membership. We're the best kept secret ever.
That's true. That's true.
Now, I assume you mentioned goals of the Board of Trustees. I assume one of your goals is more membership.
Yes.
And so you tell me how the board and the rest of us are going to get more members.
Can I come back and answer that in a year?
Don't you have, you got goals now, don't you? How are you going to reach those goals?
Well, let's hear from this lady, then I'll answer your question. There's two more. Elke?
This is just a comment to put things in perspective. I would like to suggest that other denominations did not grow exponentially either in the last 50 years. So I think we need to have a positive string on this, too.
And one question back in the corner.
I just wanted to know whether we have or they have decided on a location for the new headquarters.
Oh, it's going to be in central Boston, so everybody can get to work on public transportation.
No specific locations? Or
we just approved that they're going to have to look on the market. And
good luck.
Well, believe it or not, there's a glut of office space available in Boston. Yeah. So, and it's priced right because of the recession. So we're hoping we can get this wrapped up soon. Now, regarding growth in membership, we've been very inward looking as a denomination. And there's a lot of people who would be very happy if we kept our headquarters at 25 Beacon Street and revered the past. The fact is, already there's more minority children in this country being born than white children. By 2015, white people, like everybody in this room, will be the minority. So the question is, if we want to thrive as a congregation, we're going to have to change our ways. That's one reason we're going down to Phoenix in June to work with Latino people and helping them achieve social justice. We have a history of 40 or 50 years of taking our banners to our regional meetings and taking our banners to our General Assembly, and we march around the hall and show the banners to ourselves. And as they said up in April, up in Bloomington, Minnesota, I said, when, oh, when are we going to start showing our banners to the world, and what will become of us if we don't start doing it very soon? We just absolutely have to, if we value this religion, move forward with a program of informing people about who we are and what we do. Now, I want to say just one thing. In the last 12 years, there's been a renaissance here on the Great Plains. Wichita built a new building within the last 10 years, and they have a minister named David Clark. There's a new fellowship in Hutchinson. Salina bought the old Unity Church. They're growing. They have a minister they share with Hutchinson. Manhattan has a new building and a settled minister. Topeka has a new building and a full-time minister. Lawrence has a new building and a full-time minister. The Shawnee Mission Church just signed the contract for $1.2 million to buy a school that has a parking lot for 400 cars, an auditorium, a gym, and a cafeteria for $1.2 million. All Souls in Kansas City received an offer from the Kansas City Art Institute to buy their entire property lock, stock, and barrel at a good price. So what we've seen here in the Prairie Star District is we have had growth in terms of members, in terms of congregations, and in terms of outreach and usefulness to our members in our communities. So, yes, I know. Congratulations.
I know Graham has an appointment this afternoon, whether he might be able to stay around for a few minutes if you want to talk to him some more. In the meantime, if you would please stand as you're able and join in singing hymn number 318, We Would Be One. Thank you. closing words originally appeared in the statement of philosophy of the Coordinating Committee on Consolidation more than 50 years ago. Challenges faced by the UUA today, and indeed by this congregation, make them as relevant today as they were then. A viable organization requires a tradition, a corporate personality, clear goals, clear assignment of responsibility, effective coordination through constant communication, and a vast amount of goodwill. So be it. Thank you.
But another thing is that I've heard about guest workers, and I don't know who started it, but one of our presidents, and I won't mention his name, and other governmental senators or representatives have mentioned this guest worker, and it always sounded so great that they could come over and they could, I mean, even the computer person you mentioned could get a job as a guest worker and then send money or take money with him back to his family. And so those are just some of the things I was thinking.
Thank you, Florence.
Yeah.
So let us now stand as you want, or sit if you want, and sing hymn number 89, Come My Way, My Truth, My Life. May mother's love remind us daily of the sanctity of all life. Touch our hearts with the oneness of all creation. Make us tender to the beauty of the earth and fill us with renewing joy. Open our hearts with knowledge so that we may achieve a world of harmony and be thankful for the mothering love that guides us to create heaven here on earth now. Go in peace. Right.